Hello and welcome to Behind the Money. I'm Amy Keene, a reporter for the Financial Times in New York. This is a podcast where my FT colleagues, their sources, and I dig into the big business and financial news of the moment and get into the stories behind the headlines. This week on the show, how WeWork really works. The co-working and office-based company set out to create the office of the future.
We're changing the way people work.
And they've caught the attention of big investors like SoftBank along the way. But what does the business of office subleasing mean in terms of dollars and cents? In 2010, Adam Neumann and his partner Miguel McKelvey set up a company with the small goal of changing the way people work. They leased some space in an office building in New York, did some renovations, and turned around and rented out the updated space to new tenants. 8 years later, WeWork has opened buildings, or what they like to call communities, in more than 60 cities. After a recent round of investment from SoftBank's Vision Fund, the company is reportedly valued at $20 billion. And throughout all of these years, we've had very little understanding of how WeWork actually operates, how much it brings in revenue, what its expenses are like, and so on. It's a private company, and so it's not required to publicly report these details. But in April, WeWork issued a round of bonds, and its financial statements were made available. And it was the first time we got the chance to look inside the operations of one of the highest valued startups in the world.
So this is a company founded back in 2010 with a relatively simple business model, which is to rent offices, office buildings from large landlords, and to sublet them to smaller businesses, to divide them up and make them look a bit more funky, put some bells and whistles around them, and then effectively sell them off for a higher price to other people.
That's the voice of FT Companies editor Dan Thomas. He's also covered the global property market for many years.
This is by far and away not a new idea. This has been going on for decades, if not longer. This is a very old-fashioned real estate play. Many companies have been doing it in the past. In the UK, for example, is a company called IWG, who used to be, well, still are sometimes known as Regus because they run the Regus brand, who have got a vast network and portfolio of properties around the world where they do just this. The thing that WeWork brought to the table was a kind of sense of, that kind of Silicon Valley pizzazz, the excitement, the marketing, and indeed the technology, which they talk about quite a lot. The ability to offer their the people within their buildings the opportunity to mix with each other, to have business relationships with each other, to get to know each other. They provide amenities which weren't necessarily common. Place, 7 years ago, free coffee, free beer, even in some locations, and it takes it a bit above the sort of traditional sense of beanbags and ping pong tables, at least.
Here's Mr. Neumann in an interview with the FT from 2015.
A lot of times people ask me if we compete against co-working spaces or against Regus, and the answer is no. We're competing against office. We're changing the way people work.
And if there was a company that was going to change the way people work, investors wanted in.
WeWork attracted quite a vast array of early tech startup type investors from the venture capitalist side, as well as a little bit later on from SoftBank, or SoftBank's Vision Fund anyway, which is this vast fund designed to set up to invest in the technology sector. The interesting thing was that these investors come in thinking that this is a technology player. This is a kind of the property model of the future. It's got a typical growth sector strategy, which is you build it and then you scale it up as quickly as possible and as soon as possible. So we saw WeWork double the number of locations it has around the world last year. They have plans to do so again to about 400 locations. And this is just a scale game. They want to populate the major cities around the world with WeWorks. And eventually the hope is that these properties will turn a profit.
So if you were looking at this the way you would a real estate company and not a tech company, how does it compare?
Well, the real estate industry regards WeWork with a huge amount of suspicion, mostly because to them it's just taking a very old fashioned idea of subleasing buildings to tenants, and sort of adding a sort of veneer of kind of technology respectability to it. The thing that everyone warns about is over time the property cycle has a sort of momentum. You have a peak and a trough, a very defined peak and trough, roughly every 10 to 15 years around the world, history would suggest. And right now the property markets probably near or even in some places probably reached a cyclical top. So what the danger is here, and what property experts and property investors would be worried about, particularly in relation to backing WeWork right now, would be that WeWork is effectively taking leases on these large buildings and then subletting them at the moment for a little bit more. But should the market turn, they'll be on the hook for, say, 15-20 year leases. And they won't be able to get the returns because their own tenants will be starting to demand lower rents than they're paying at the moment, because there might be a cyclical downturn and they can find office rents elsewhere for much cheaper. And the problem is that this is a relatively low barriers to entry market as well. So, I mean, all it takes is one building down the road to put a 20% discount on their office rents, and suddenly they look much more attractive to tenants, which can move very quickly. That, you know, these are companies which typically have maybe a year on their contract, maybe a longer, but even so, they can move in relatively short order, which means they can move down the road very quickly, and it can leave a building such as the vast ones that WeWork tend to take, it can leave them quite empty quite quickly. That is the worst case scenario. They would argue, on the other hand, which I've heard them say, that, you know, the reason why people would naturally stay in their buildings is because of the technology advantages they offer, the, you know, the extra sort of amenities, the community around it.
Who makes up the bulk of their tenants?
WeWork has traditionally attracted a number of smaller businesses. Inevitably, that's what shared office space is all about. You know, you don't tend to want to have the big floor plates. You're literally looking for maybe a few desks to a few tens of desks. But the thing is, they have been trying to shift, aggressively shift into the larger corporate space. And they're trying to do that by offering, you know, the large banks, let's say Citi, for example. They'll go to Citi and say, well, you have got a large building up the road. That's yours, of course. But why don't you have a breakout team which comes and sits with effectively the kids, because they tend to be younger, younger tenants in their buildings. And, you know, they're sort of saying, well, these guys are the ones that are sparking the ideas for the future. And it would benefit for you if you took some space in our offices as well. And they're also trying to pivot into offering more traditional asset management services to these companies as well, by saying, look, we can take on running maybe a floor, maybe two floors, maybe a building on your behalf, and using our skills in order to do that. But I mean, the thing is, actually, some of the more kind of cliched or sort of maybe traditional tenants of WeWork, the very small startups, the really early stage firms, they're almost being priced out of the market, because WeWork is not cheap compared to many of its competitors down the road who are now setting up shop anyway. And you can get cheaper office space, generally speaking, if you're a small startup, which, you know, with a couple of beanbags in a corner and a coffee machine can replicate the WeWork experience fairly accurately.
So this is what WeWork's been up to, aggressively growing its footprint in major cities around the world. And just a couple of weeks ago, we finally got to see whether the company was in a position to turn a profit anytime soon. I talked to my colleague Alex Skaggs, who's been poring over the statements for the FT. Alex, okay. When you first heard that WeWork was issuing bonds, what did you do? What did you look for?
So the first thing that went through my mind was, I have to get my hands on this prospectus. And a prospectus is a document that the company sends out to the people who might buy its bonds, just so they can sort of look at the company. It includes all of the company's financial metrics and the ways that these investors are going to like evaluate the investment and the company.
Alex said the prospectus was about 260 pages long, so I'll cut to the chase and tell you the three numbers she immediately looked for. The first was assets, and whether the company owns anything that a bond investor might be able to lay claim to if WeWork's not able to repay its debt.
So what I found was that WeWork doesn't really own very much, because its basic model, like we said, was that it leases out buildings over the long term and then rents them out short term. The vast majority of what it actually has on its balance sheet are leases, and leases don't actually involve like a claim over any asset.
The second thing she looked for was the net profit or loss. WeWork's bottom line.
So people had reported that the company was loss-making, that it hadn't turned an official profit. But we didn't know just how big the losses were. And they've reported that a few different ways. But, you know, the very top line level, I guess, of this report was almost $1 billion, which is a lot of money. That was actually more than their revenue for the whole year. So they lost, I think, about $933 million for 2017.
And the reason for the loss of this scale is largely because of the company's rapid growth. They're expanding to new cities, opening up new buildings, and all of that is quite expensive. Which brings us to the third item, cash. How much cash WeWork has after accounting for its operations, the money that's coming in and out of WeWork, and how much of it stays within the company in order for it to pay taxes and the interest on its debt. WeWork has coined their calculation of this community-adjusted EBITDA.
So in the prospectus, it is funny because they do seem to sort of use this as a way to show like, hey, our business is really good. We'll have plenty of cash, you guys. But in order to do that, they actually take out a lot of expenses. And these expenses are substantial and they really matter for the company's global operations. I mean, their global sales, you know, their entire staff and business that's dedicated to opening up new buildings. They take that out entirely. They take out all of the expenses for all the buildings that haven't opened yet. Basically, what they're trying to do is figure out how, like for a location that's already open and operating, they're trying to figure out how profitable are these.
And in doing so, I guess they're stripping out the costs associated with growing today, the actual cost of the expanding operation.
Exactly. So they are expanding very fast. And before they open these buildings, obviously, they aren't bringing in membership revenue, which, you know, in order to sort of get that amount of membership revenue, they have to bring in a lot of people to sell the memberships, and they have to actually renovate the buildings a lot of times. And so they have this sort of decent sized stock of buildings that haven't actually opened up yet. And so because of that, those things are kind of expensive. So that really weighed on their profits.
Another question I had for Alex was why WeWork was going to the debt market now.
So WeWork had been getting cash from equity issuance, which is basically saying, okay, you can have a stake in my business if you give me some money. And it had these credit lines open with banks at the same time, which is basically just going to the bank and saying, hey, you can lend to me and I'll pay you back interest. And so it actually said in its documents that it wasn't able to borrow that much more money from banks as of the end of last year. And at the same time, you have to imagine that shareholders, you know, they don't want more shareholders with them, right? Like it's this idea of shareholder dilution, which is basically that, you know, the more shares you issue, the smaller ownership stake every existing shareholder has.
Alex, you've characterized a company that might not on paper be your typical debt issuer. They've got minimal assets, limited cash flow. Who invested in this debt?
So the funny thing is, I can't actually say a lot about the people who bought this debt because I had a lot of trouble finding them. A lot of debt investors who I spoke to said, not for us. Because it's like not a typical bond offering, typical bond investors do not seem to like this credit very much. You know, the bonds actually in the secondary market, which means like the place that investors trade bonds after they've already been issued, it's been trading at about 93 cents on the dollar, which this soon after an offering is almost unheard of.
So it's not the kind of debt traditional bond investors are looking to get their hands on. And you might ask why this matters. It's a private company. But Alex told me that a lot of analysts would consider this a trial balloon for an IPO. WeWork's chief executive has been quite open about the idea of taking WeWork public in the near future. So working with a bank on the debt issuance, testing investor reaction, the company might be slowly wading into the waters. Dan, given what we've seen from their financials so far, how would you say WeWork would fare under the scrutiny of reporting quarterly earnings and answering to public shareholders?
I think WeWork would struggle slightly in the public market right now. I think the information that the company disclosed to the market after the bond issuance was enough to really really kind of concern some people and certainly surprise some people about, you know, how much money the company was burning through, you know, the level of profitability that it was aiming for within its existing business. And indeed, how much it didn't tell us. For example, they disclosed that they wrote off a $30 million investment in 2016 for a partial stake in a company. WeWork didn't actually say which company this was, although some people, I think, have linked it with the purchase of a company from Spain, which builds and operates wave pools for surfing, which happens to be a hobby of the chief executive, Mr. Newman. So, I mean, there have been sort of skeptics out there who say that you know, that's, if that is true, that this money was spent on effectively a surfboard indoor surf company, then that's not money that well spent potentially. And so this is not the sort of behaviour which will necessarily be seen as favourable within the public markets. Saying that, you know, the equity markets are always capable of surprising, and indeed capable of backing, you know, ambitious people with great visions, and potentially in a couple of years' time, these 200 extra units which are opening in the next year, they could be turning a profit. So, you know, it's not impossible to see WeWork turn a corner pretty quickly in order to get to the public markets, should it want to.
And there's a bigger bet here that I want to understand, and that's what else the company is, I guess, looking to disrupt. What it is that SoftBank and its Vision Fund, along with other venture capital, what are they interested in?
Adam Newman and indeed his wife, who takes a strong voice in this business, both see themselves as much more than providing shared offices here. You know, they really want to, reinvent the workplace, reinvent the urban space as much as anything else. They want to take control to some degree, you know, of the living space that perhaps workers will work in, as well as their offices, and indeed, you know, things alongside it on the social side, so they can really, really address what some people are calling the we generation, or he likes to call the we generation, you know, who really wants to do cool things and actually likes to go to work. This is not necessarily a bad idea. You know, you can kind of see the reason why they would want to do this. I mean, it's a vast and impressive vision of how people will be working in the future, which is that, you know, they're no longer wanting to go from a 9-to-5 job and head home to the suburbs. And so it's more of a sort of kind of conceptual idea about where the world is heading to. And that's really where SoftBank comes in, because I mean they've been huge supporters of the company. And if you ever read interviews with the executives running SoftBank, you know they're hugely excited about the opportunity to back a company which has these ambitions. They don't want to back a shared office provider. There's plenty of them out there, much smaller valuations, it has to be said, but at the same time with much less idea about how the future is going to work out. If WeWork is right, and this is the sort of next revolution in how people work and live, then they are going to be right at the vanguard of that. They're going to have, you know, 400, 500, 600 and so on places around the world where they can offer this.
If we look at the big figures in this story, a $702 million bond issuance, a valuation of $20 billion, how are you thinking about what this company is?
I think WeWork needs to be positioned not next to Regus, but more importantly, next to some company like Tesla, who equally are seen off a vast valuation, but are equally burning through stacks of cash in order to get to where they need to get to make money. So it's just a real bet on the vision of Adam Newman, and whether or not come 2025, 2030, there's a real shift in how people live and work. But growth for its own sake clearly is never going to be enough. Eventually the company will have to turn a profit. We'll have to show that its strategy is a sustainable one, not just for 3 to 5 years, but through the 15, 20-year cycle of their leases and beyond. And only then can they say that actually this has been a successful company. At the moment, it's a very exciting company. It has fantastic marketing, has some great technology behind it, undoubtedly. But at the moment, it needs to prove that it can be there for the long term.
If you'd like to read more on WeWork, we've linked to Dan's column and Alex's deep dives on the company and its financials in the summary for this episode. And you can, of course, find more on FT.com. Thanks to everyone who has emailed with story ideas and episode feedback for Behind the Money. Keep it coming. You can email me at behindthemoney@ft.com, or you can find me on Twitter at Amy P. Keen. We'll be back next week.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.